from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In the age of the Internet, are history textbooks still relevant? Well, Stanford education professor Sam Weinberg studies how history is taught in the U.S. and why traditional teaching methods are failing to engage today's students who, as digital natives, look online for information. Weinberg thinks that history teachers should de-emphasize textbooks and focus on teaching kids how to differentiate the good online information from the bad. He'll join us to discuss how we can help kids become better students of history, and we'll talk about his new book, Why Learn History When It's Already on Your Phone. That's coming up next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. With even obscure historical information readily available online, what's the point of memorizing facts like the names of the original 13 colonies or the major battles of the Civil War? Not much point, according to Stanford education professor Sam Weinberg, but what kids do need, he argues, are the skills to differentiate between accurate and inaccurate information and the ability to overcome confirmation bias. Former high school history teacher, he joins us this hour to discuss navigating online information, the myth of a golden age of fact retention, and his new book, Why Learn History When It's Already on Your Phone. And welcome, Sam Weinberg.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Delighted to have you here. A sentence of yours seems to loom in my consciousness. The Internet has obliterated authority. Let's take this into the thesis, though, that you're working with here. We have a digital free-for-all out there. We don't know what to believe anymore where our history is concerned.
We certainly don't. Anybody with a cheap web template and a little bit of ingenuity can become an historian. You don't need a license to practice historiography on the Internet.
It's also frightening and bleak in many ways. I mean, there's a lot of hope in your book as well. But when you think about, I mean, some of the statistics that you present to us, 82% of middle school kids can't tell the difference between historical fact and or news, if you will, and an ad.
Well, that is a finding that should concern us, but I would like to state from the outset that we shouldn't indict our young people, because there was an industry study done by Berlin Edelman where 59% of adults had a difficult time telling the difference between what we call sponsored content, an ad masquerading as a news story, and news itself. So we're all in the same boat, and the boat is not faring too well.
And the boat is maybe, unless we do something, and there has been some shift. We'll talk about textbooks and so forth, pedagogy, but the boat may sink us yet. I mean, we hear a lot from our president about fake news, but fake news is so ubiquitous now that we have to learn. And your book is a real, I think, important, in many ways, document telling us how much we need to learn the difference between sorting through and contextualizing the truth and finding sources as opposed to accepting what's there on the Internet.
Exactly. We need to do a sea change in terms of how we educate our young people as well as how we educate our general populace. This is an issue of public education writ large, not just what goes on in schooling, but the education of a public that at this present moment is very confused, as you said.
Well, let's talk about some of the examples you use, because you start out with, for example, the Virginia Post, and there's a story about a story that's palpably false about Confederate soldiers fighting for the Confederacy, but they happen to be slaves. And the reality of that is it's not a reality. You trace it down, and it comes from this group online called the Sons of the Confederacy Veterans. I mean, very what my kids would call sketchy story to begin with, but there is essentially something that's disseminated as the truth.
What's particularly concerning about that example, Michael, is that that example made its way into a textbook for fourth graders in the state of Virginia. So it was actually printed and vetted and went through the State Board of Education and ended up in the hands of young people. And when the author of the textbook, whose name is Joy Massoff, was interviewed by the Washington Post reporter, she said what many of us would say, I do my research on the Internet. And so this is the modern condition. For many of the questions that we have to answer, we don't go to the public library and bury ourselves inside the stacks. We turn on our computers and go to our browser and Google something. And this is the present state that we all find ourselves in.
Present state is also one where the old style of learning history, piece by piece, you know, we're going to cover the Civil War today, we're going to cover World War II tomorrow, that sort of thing, is receding somewhat, isn't it? I mean, they're getting the message out there in the world of pedagogy and not necessarily forcing rote memorization the way it used to be done.
That's true. There are changes, and there are many, many excellent teachers that are toiling and recognizing that the condition that we're in and devoting and getting up early in the morning and kind of working as hard as they can to ameliorate this problem. At the same time, we're still in a condition, a kind of Procrustean bed, where kids are lugging around 5-pound textbooks that number 1,000 pages that really served us at a time when there was a scarcity of sources. Back when I was growing up and I confronted a particular question in the daily newspaper, if I wanted to question that newspaper, perhaps I could go to our set of World Book Encyclopedias that we had, or I can consult another book in on the bookshelves in our house. But there was a scarcity of sources. Today, we're faced with a very different problem. We're faced with an overabundance of sources. So really, what should our response be when all of the information that was contained in the World Book Encyclopedia that I had as a youngster, that and much more is sitting in my back pocket on a device?
Yeah, I had rule books in my house, too. wanted to read them all as much as I could. But we get facts in a very different way now, as you're saying. And the modes of thought are what you write about, too. I mean, they kind of counteract or maybe even encourage haste in many ways. What I mean they counteract is the kind of care that goes into looking and searching and sourcing. You're trying to avert these kind of premature judgments and emphasis on really looking down, hunting down. But most people will tell you, I don't have the time to do that, right?
Well, this is the condition that we find ourselves in when every statement that comes out of the White House or out of the Beltway, should we take it as fact because it comports with what we already believe? Or should we do the most basic thing that we can do logically in the social world, which is to ask, what is the evidence for a particular claim? And unfortunately, and traditionally in the way that we've taught history and the way that we've often taught many of the subjects in school, we teach kids facts as ready-made without giving them the capability and cultivating the capability for them to ask the question, what is the relationship between claim and evidence? That really is the fundamental question that a citizen has to answer in today's society.
I'm glad you mentioned citizen because this really mirrors the importance of these kind of concepts in democracy and really in making enduring democracy. How do you make sense of all the information coming to you? And have you changed how you consume information in recent years? Let me throw that question out to our listeners and, in fact, invite your response to it. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us now. And again, you can do that by calling us toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also do that by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting any questions or comments or any thoughts you have in this conversation we're having with Sam Weinberg onto the Internet, kqed.org/forum. And we don't want to necessarily inhibit your use of the Internet, especially when it comes to this show. You can also join us, of course, by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or going to our Facebook page. And there's a good deal of indictment in your book, Howard Zinn's version of history. I want to get into that, but also the testing industry. Let's talk about that.
The testing industry hasn't fundamentally changed since we started to quiz kids on the kinds of trivial pursuit questions that appeared on the first test of historical facts in 1918. And in that particular test, there's a quotation from the authors, "Surely a grade of 33 on 100 of the most basic facts of American history is a statement that no high school can be proud of." Now, that's the kind of quote that has an endurance across the 20th century and into the 21st. So as I tell my own students who are preparing to be teachers, that they can take solace in the fact that they are no more ignorant than their grandparents or their great-grandparents.
Or maybe not the historians themselves. You found out, for example, a lot of historians don't have these kind of facts at the ready.
Well, we typically think that historians are walking encyclopedias who are able to master copious amounts of factual information. And about their particular specialty, I think that might be true. But I did, one of my earliest studies was to give historians whose specialties were in world history or colonization in South America or Japan the kinds of questions we give to high school students about American history in their chapter review questions. And lo and behold, the historians, in many cases, did worse on these multiple choice questions than high school students who were taking an AP course.
Talking with Sam Weinberg, who essentially is telling us these tools for information are taking controlling us rather than us controlling them. He's professor of education at Stanford, author of a book called Why Learn History, parenthetically, when it's already on your phone and it's all there for, at the ready, isn't it?
Well, the information is there, but our phone cannot teach us discernment. And that's the fundamental educational question that's before us. How do we cultivate discernment among a citizenry that at this present moment is very confused?
Well, you talk about epistemology crossed with agency. There's an interesting formula. Edify us a little bit on that, would you?
Well, epistemology is a fancy word that philosophers use for establishing knowledge claims. How do we know that we know? And traditionally in school, we knew what we knew because the textbook told us. But we are in an age where the minute kids get out of school or the minute we go on the internet, it's not a textbook telling us, it's what Google produces. And so the question, how do we know, has to have deeper and more stable foundations than simply the text or the, I found it on the internet. That's what, to go back to my earlier comment, that's what got the woman who wrote the textbook in Virginia in trouble. The internet told me.
The internet tells you all kinds of things. It, you use an example in Australia of Holocaust denial, I mean, which the internet tells you, which sometimes creeps into life in all sorts of strange ways. Also an interesting example in Rialto, California. Can you talk about that?
In Rialto, California, in 2014, a group of middle school teachers who were responding to an educational reform known as the Common Core, which is supposedly trying to cultivate these kinds of intellectual capabilities, the ability to deal with multiple conflicting interpretations. They wanted to give their students documents about a historical controversy, and they focused on the Holocaust. And the question that they put before 7th and 8th graders was the Holocaust a hoax? And they found documents on the internet, and one of the documents was a Holocaust denial document from a group called BibleBelievers.org and from Australia that claims that the Diary of Anne Frank is a forgery, that the pictures that we see, the horrific pictures we see of corpses lined up in the concentration camps were not actually of murdered Jews and gypsies, but actually of German soldiers. And when the reporter from the newspaper in San Bernardino, his name is Bo Yarborough, he won an award for this story, when he contacted the school district and said, were there young people who actually wrote essays, middle school students who wrote essays denying the Holocaust? The school district said, no, it was just an exercise. And through California's version of the Freedom of Information Act, he obtained the essays. And lo and behold, whole groups of 7th and 8th graders were turned into Holocaust deniers, writing essays about why the Holocaust was a hoax based on information that these teachers, and I think it was really, I don't impute prejudice or bigotry to the teachers. I think that they were confused and they were taken in by a document that had all of the trappings of scholarship, but they thought that the document was a legitimate historical document and they put it in the hands of middle school students.
So there is a responsibility here to question and also to source things and do that with every single prerogative that's necessary to do that. But you're talking about teachers who themselves are misinformed and who are relying on digital information.
Well, I don't want to indict teachers, Michael. I think that we're
an education professor.
We're in a state where really all of us are confused. And research that we did that's also in the book talks about academics who, taken outside of their particular specialty in academics and the humanities, asked to review internet sources about adolescent bullying, were also taken in by a group called the American College of Pediatricians, which on the face of it, on their website, it's a .org, it's a 501c3. It has all of the appearance of being legitimate, but they were taken in by it. And actually, this group is a rabidly anti-gay group. It's been labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And so this is a situation we all find ourselves in. We Google something, something comes up in our search results. It conforms to what we think an authoritative source looks like, and we believe it.
Talking to Sam Weinberg, his book is Why Learn History When It's Already on Your Phone, and he's professor of education at Stanford. Let's hear from some of our callers. I asked a question before, is how do you make sense of all the information coming at you, and have you changed how you consume information in recent years? And let's go first to you, Grant. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Appreciate the conversation. I feel like I'm pretty good at discerning truth. I'm a research buff. However, I have three children. My oldest one is 7 years old. What is the best way to combat misinformation? I feel like now I need to be the parent. When other kids come over, they see a bunch of books on a bunch of bookshelves, because I feel like books are disappearing. People are getting their information. I mean, what is the best way as a young parent in the Bay Area who works 60 hours a week to afford the mortgage, a way that I can combat that so that my kids get good information as they grow older? I always think of the paradigm in which we're operating, and this concerns me.
Grant, it concerns a lot of people, and I'm thankful to you for your question. Sam Weinberg, some wisdom from you on this?
The best advice I can give you, Grant, is what we learned from actually watching professional fact-checkers as they evaluated information on the internet. And what they did is something very different from a comparison group of, for instance, Stanford undergraduates. What fact-checkers did was they did not let their eyes deceive them. When they came to a website that they were unfamiliar with, that they had never heard of before, that looked official, that had a .org, that had all of the kinds of authoritative signals that would seem to point to it being a reliable source, they did what we call lateral reading. They left the site rather than investing far too much time in going to the about page or the things, for instance, that web credibility sites tell you to do. Look at the about page or look if it's a .org or a .com. They ignored all of those things. And the way that they established whether it was a reliable site was to open up multiple tabs across the horizontal axis of their screen and learn about the organization telling them something. And this is a very different way of reading, for instance, than how we've learned how to read in print, where our eyes go vertically up and down the page. Novices or people who are not very skilled at vetting information on the internet will invest a great deal of time on a particular page without really knowing whether it's worth their time. And looking at a logo or looking at a name of an organization, so much money is involved right now in the advocacy and persuading citizens of a particular point of view that we cannot let our eyes deceive us. We have to learn about an organization. And interestingly enough, one of the places that fact checkers went often was Wikipedia, but they used Wikipedia in a way that was very different from the rest of us.
You got to essentially have the initiative here, too. I mean, indolence can creep into this. A lot of people just fact check without fact checking. I mean, they just look at something very quickly, or they look at something with alacrity. And when you talk about expenditures, it reminds me of the fact that there is a kind of indictment in your book about the failure of the federal government here. There have been efforts, including spending billions of dollars when it comes to from between 2001 and 2012 to a great extent. That's according to some figures I was looking at.
There was a program from 2000 to 2011 called the Teaching American History Program, of which your tax dollars and my tax dollars contributed to over $1 billion on teacher professional development. And unfortunately, what it points to, Michael, I think that the story that can be told is that, well, there were a great many efforts that were devoted toward cultivating intellectual skills and the powers of discernment that I'm very interested in and I think that we need as a citizenry. Our means of assessment was stuck in the mud. And so that was the weak link. We were still teaching, we were still assessing young people as well as participants in this program with multiple choice tests, the kinds of things that are on their phones. And we haven't invested, we haven't made the kind of investment in developing assessments that will truly cultivate the intellectual skills that will promote a flourishing democracy.
As you also pointed out, we go back to the testing, that often questions which are thought too easy are simply omitted or aren't a part of these kind of quizzes and tests, like Martin Luther King was assassinated, that type of thing.
This goes back to the culture of testing, really, that was started at the end of the last century, where you have the invention of the multiple choice item and you have a whole field of psychometrics that's developed based on, for instance, a discrimination index, how well a particular item discriminates among students of different abilities. And so I don't know if your listeners or you're familiar with what the wrong answers are actually called in the jargon of testers. They're called distractors. And so if a wrong answer is not successfully distracting students and attracting the wrong answers, then better distractors are put in its place. And to me, that seems to be criminal. As educators, we should not be in the business of distracting students. And so much of the minutia we find on multiple choice tests, on history tests, on social studies tests, on other tests, on the distractors that are there are not because we think it's important information or we think that it's important to discriminate between these answers. It's there because it works mathematically, and that has to be stopped.
Talking to Sam Weinberg, his book again is Why Learn History, and let me bring another caller aboard here, and that's you, Rob. Rob, join us.
Thank you. This is a great topic. Obviously, we need to teach kids more on how to think and critical thinking. But one of the best classes I had in college was logic, and it really taught me how to look at advertising, you know, simple advertising and what the pitfalls were. And after that class and really learning to trust my gut, I found that it really opened a lot of possibilities for just looking at things and saying, no, that's BS. You know, you learn to recognize what's real and what's not, if you can kind of apply that and teach kids how to trust their gut and how to use it and how to look for falsehoods and how to recognize them easily.
Thank you for that call. You suggest actually kind of a triage when it comes to facts, Sam Weinberg?
Absolutely. I am not someone who says that knowledge is unimportant. All you have to do is look at your child's textbook and see how much is crammed in there. What we do with textbooks is we never make them shorter. History is still continuing. We're always adding new chapters. We're adding without eliminating. Now, the human mind's ability to retain this kind of information has not changed over the years. And so information becomes encoded in memory through repeated exposure and through connections to other information. And when more and more is added, then there's less and less a chance that that information will actually be retained and useful to us.
That brings me, if I may, to Howard Zinn. I said earlier that I wanted to talk with you about him. There are about 2 million copies of his book, History of the United States, uses textbooks in print presently. And you essentially argue that even though, you know, there may be a kind of feeling of moral superiority because he puts a lot of emphasis on victims in American history, Native Americans, for example, and people taken to internment camps, etc., that it's still monolithic. It still presents a historical view that, for the most part, very little footnotes and very little sourcing.
Howard Zinn performed an incredible service to the American public by bringing history of people whose histories were not told to a broad reading audience. But there is a problem, in my opinion, with a history that begins with a sense of who's right and who's wrong before the documentary record has even been consulted.
Hold that thought. I want to could pursue that with you, but we're coming up on a break, and I want to remind listeners how you can join us. We'd like to know, how do you make sense of all the information coming at you, and have you changed how you consume information in recent years? And you can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Sam Weinberg, education professor at Stanford and author of Why Learn History When It's Already on Your Phone. And he is indeed very much in favor of learning history, the need and importance of investigating our past. And he makes that case in his book. And he also feels that there's certainly some hope with young people. Cites, for example, a number of young people queried about who they admire most and coming up with names like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and Harriet Tubman. But the question is, how do you separate fact from fiction or falsehood? And how do you, for that matter, find the truth when you're indeed doling out history in textbooks or in the classroom or, for that matter, in your everyday life, seeking it. We were talking before we went to the break about Howard Zinn, who was often described as a radical historian, mentor to Alice Walker, who's been in hot water lately for something she said in the New York Times Book Review about admiring a writer, but also certainly a strongly admired historian. And I remember, let me get you back on track here, Sam, if I may, but I remember a rather strong argument I had with Lynn Cheney, no less, who then was head of National Endowment and Humanities, and she was saying that history was being too much, like in Regents and testing and everything, too much emphasis on Japanese being rounded up, on Native Americans being persecuted, on slavery, that there has to be a different sense of history that covers much more of a wider berth. Now, is this a problem when we approach somebody like Howard Zinn, in your judgment?
In Howard Zinn's case, yes. I think that, but we can't indict Zinn on that point because Zinn was writing in response to textbooks with names like Triumph of the American Nation or American Pageant. So in that sense, he performed a very important service of telling us the other side of the things that are typically left out of mainstream textbooks. So I don't think on that score he is he's guilty in any particular way.
And yet you say that there's a kind of monolithic approach that Zinn offers too.
Well, again, I think that in many senses, Zinn is the other side of the coin of a book that with a name like Triumph of the American Nation. When you begin with marching orders for going into the documentary record and selecting a pass that conforms to a particular thesis, then history becomes less of an intellectual pursuit and more of an act of advocacy or of, one might even say, partisanship.
So we need context always, and we also need, and I think you make this argument pretty specifically, chronology. I mean, again, history is often presented in these kind of little morsels or tidbits. Like I said, oh, today we're going to study the Founding Fathers. Tomorrow we'll be studying the Civil War.
We absolutely need chronology, but we need to distinguish chronology from a kind of fetishization of dates. So in many cases on multiple choice tests, on the tests that we give to our high school students, they have to remember a particular date. But when you talk to educated people who have a sense of arc of history, they don't remember a specific date. They have more of a squishy feeling of when things happened. I can give you an example. When was Brown versus Board of Education?
1954.
Well, 1954. Well, you remember that, Michael. But many people might say, well, now, wait a second. Was it actually, the case was decided in 54, but it was started in 52. So is that wrong? If somebody said 1920, now that would really indicate that they are lacking a sense of the arc of the civil rights movement in the United States. If they said 1965 and put it on the middle of Great Society and the war on poverty, then also that would indicate that they are lacking a sense of the arc of history. But if they put it in the mid-50s, then you can probably have a sense that, okay, they've got a sense of the general contour of what happened. And that's the way that we, most educated people, think of chronology. Less of a specific date in a particular year, in a particular month, and more of a general sense. Did the Cuban Missile Crisis occur in 1945? 1955?
No, I 1965? Believe it was 1962, I think.
Well, you think. 62 or 61?
62.
Okay.
But, you know, this reminds me also of something Susan Sontag wrote about, which was how we tend to see history or experience history in decades. And she felt that that was wrong. I mean, you talk about the 60s, for example, and everybody has all kinds of associations with the 60s, counterculture and Ted Rozek's idea of the counterculture, all those kinds of things. And yet, you know, the 60s, it kind of homogenizes the 60s, to speak of it that way. I don't want to get into the weeds here, but I think she had a point.
Absolutely. One of the studies that we did was way back when we gave about 15 years ago, we gave a group of high school students pictures of protests during the Vietnam War. And when you look at the pictures as a child of that era, you look at the protesters and you see them as having long hair. But actually, in today's context, they are clean cut. And so what we seem to think of, we associate the 60s because our understanding of the past becomes stylized with a picture of a hippie with long hair going down to his shoulders with a headband on. But when you look at protests of the Vietnam War, you would look at many of the young people sitting in these protests as clean cut young Americans.
There's also Susan Sontag's point that we associate maybe with long hair or with hippies and so forth, but that's a kind of class division in many ways. You know, there are many proletarian kids and working class kids and people of color who didn't fit that stereotype that's so strongly associated and identified with that decade. So the decade homogenizes in another way with class. Anyway, that's Susan Sontag's argument. We'll bring some more callers in here, and let's go to Greg next. Greg, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. Hey, and thank you for another excellent discussion on an important topic by a very relevant author. And I would just say that it's very relevant in the sense that who we have in the White House, Trump and company, or as I refer to him as the Lakotas, the liar-in-chief of the United States. But I would agree with your author. I think it's very important to teach analytical skills in trying to discern truth. And in fact, when I was in high school way back in the 60s, there was a class that was required from everybody in high school. It was called civics. And in that class, they taught us how to determine what was propaganda, the various elements of it. And I don't know if that's still being taught, but I think it's a very important part of discerning when somebody is telling you the truth or telling you BS. Now, the difference I would have with the author is, forgetting about dates and whether people have long hair or not, there are important lessons from history that need to be taught. And, for instance, the Vietnam War, I think a lot of the lesson, and I think one of the most important lessons, which was that we can't win a war for some other people. In spite of our massive military and everything else, the other people have to be committed to win it themselves. And we lost that concept somewhere along the way when we went into Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's because the people, the generations later, didn't learn that lesson. We didn't teach it. We need to teach the lessons of history.
I think we're in agreement with that, aren't you, Sam Weinberg?
Well, I think that the lessons of history is exactly the kind of thing that we should be talking about in history class. But rather than teaching them as rules or things fixed in time or set in amber, these are precisely the kinds of things that are worthy of debate. And so with all due respect to the caller, is that something tried and true for all time? Did we remove Iraq from Kuwait? Is Kuwait today a sovereign country? Can we point to some success?
Well, lessons come out of interpretation and analysis, or should. Right?
Exactly, and that is debatable. And what isn't debatable are facts. And what we've lost is a distinction between the establishment of factual knowledge that serves as the basis of debate and interpretation about the meaning of those facts. And we're in a particular historical moment where the very issue of facticity is under assault. And in many cases, that assault is coming from the White House. So in that sense, I would agree with the caller.
I remember Kellyanne Conway talking about alternate facts. Mark wants to know, are facts obsolete?
Facts are absolutely not obsolete. It's precisely what propagandists want us to believe. This is chapter and verse out of Soviet Leninistic propaganda.
And fascist propaganda.
And fascist propaganda, exactly. This is George Orwell and Winston Smith in 1984, the kind of ministry of truth, of manufacturing facts. No, the first thing that a totalitarian or fascist government wants is to assault our understanding and make us so confused that we throw our hands up in the air and we say we don't know what to believe. And that is a slippery slope to a non-democratic form of government.
Here's a strong response from a listener named Roger who says with capitals, stop using the phrase fake news. It is basically meaningless because each person has their own interpretation of what constitutes fake news.
Well, if each person has, again, the term fake news, the minute the president started to use it, and again, this is from the playbook of propagandists to take a criticism that's leveled at you and to throw it back at those who are leveling it. And Trump and
on the other hand, there is a lot of fake news out there, as we've been saying.
There's a lot of fake news, but to say that there is no truth in the news, For instance, let's take just the classic, a very classic case of Trump's claim that there were more people at his inauguration than at Obama's inauguration. Is that fake news? Yes, that is absolutely fake news. We can establish through aerial photographs of the National Park Service. We can establish through the corroboration of multiple sources of evidence that there were fewer people there. Michael, if we can't agree on facts, then we are obliged as a citizenry to go to our state and federal prisons and unlock all of the doors and let everyone out because they claim that their convictions are based on fake news. If we as a society can't establish what a fact is and a consensus about facts, we have no basis for even having a judicial system.
Well, the president saying that there were more at his inauguration, more people than there were at Obama's, is either a lie or a self-deception, but it's not a fact. There's a distinction, I think. We don't know if it's a lie or a self-deception, though, do we?
But we do know it. We know it's not a fact. We know it's not a fact,
yeah,
exactly. And we know that it is a fact that there were more people at Obama's inauguration.
Here's a tweet from a listener. It says, history is always a matter of partisanship. That is what we need to teach. Dates are the things that can be looked up. Why, who profits, et cetera. Those are the real issues. And let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Michelle. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm really enjoying this discussion. I think, Sam, you're one of the best people he's had on the show talking about this issue. There's something that makes me positive and something that makes me kind of sad about the whole thing. I'm a nurse, and we know about infections, and this is like an infection. And what I have been doing, I realize, is using widespread antibiotic or widespread reading of a variety of sources and trying to get to know authors I can trust, like Stephen Frum and et cetera, Malcolm Nance. And then the thing is that what makes me sad is our schools are so strapped. They have such high numbers of students in each class, and then we don't get that education or the money evenly distributed so that students can have that information. And also, one of the things I've been doing with claims by different people running for campaign, and when they run against each other and they say different things, I go to YouTube and try to actually hear what the actual candidate is saying from their either their site or their channel, and hear them speak for themselves. And that seems like what history can teach us is going to primary sources and seeing that as something that's helpful. And I'd be interested in your feedback.
Kudos to you for that, Michelle. And some thoughts from you, Sam Weinberg.
First, thank you, Michelle, for that's a very nice comment that you made. Listen, you're absolutely right. Schools are strapped. But we are in a moment that I think the parallel that comes to mind is a post-Gutenberg moment. After movable type was invented, there was a great deal of confusion in society. And rather than everything being clear because literacy was extended and books were able to be produced cheaply, there was a time of mass confusion and chaos. And we are all finding ourselves in a time where there is so much information, much of it not credible, but there is an overabundance of information, and we simply have not caught up as a society. And so, yes, our schools have not yet caught up, and it's going to take a good decade before we figure this out. What we're doing with our first response, and I think this is natural, and I'm not indicting anyone about this, is many schools will create a moat around the internet, and they'll see it as a very dangerous place and protect students from it, at the same time that practically every one of these high school students has a smartphone in their back pocket. So what are we doing? Are we protecting students from the real world, or are we preparing them to flourish in it? And schools are kind of not yet up to the task. We blame our kids for these kinds of things, of not knowing the difference between ads and news stories, but the kind of skills that we're talking about are not widely taught in schools. So we can't blame young people for not knowing things that they haven't been taught.
Another question about pedagogy, and that is, we used to talk a lot in the 60s, back to the 60s, about relevancy. And you talk about making history relevant and making it not boring. I remember an interview I did with Gore Vidal many years ago where he said, how could history be boring? You know, it's storytelling. It's fascinating. It's engaging. It's everything that narratives and stories ought to be. But it is. It remains a big question. And the question comes down to sort of the example. You got a kid, he's from the inner city in New Jersey or something. He's supposed to learn about the westward expansion, and that's how's that relevant to his life?
Well, I think the westward expansion is relevant to everybody's life. The question of the Trail of Tears, the question of whose rights were being trampled in on and over in the westward expansion, the kinds of difficult choices that people faced, even the choices, for instance, in what we call the Progressive Era and the Dawes Act, where we took Native children and brought them to boarding schools. Were the people who did that, obviously, we look at it, we indict them today, and we say, how cruel. But the people who actually did it at the time were considered some of the most liberal people of society, that they were trying to upgrade, where they were trying to bring indigenous peoples into what they thought was society. And so oftentimes we wag an accusing finger at people in the past. But really, the past gives us an opportunity to hold a mirror to our own present and to ask ourselves, what is it about our present that we are not seeing, that we ourselves are not recognizing our own injustices in the present moment?
So there's a relevance.
There is. We can always find relevance in our past. It is who we are today.
Let me thank Michelle for her call and go right to another caller, and that's you, Craig. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to highlight a book I read a couple of months ago called Factfulness. I think it's by Hans. I've forgotten his last name. But it gets to an important point, which is that even people, when you think we're kind of educated, how we get our information and where it comes from can be subtly wrong and biased in various ways. And he deals a lot with how our perceptions of the world are kind of shaped in the wrong ways, that even we think we're doing a good job of understanding. And so one of the examples he gives, and maybe this will highlight it entirely, is most people think that the number of deaths and danger caused by natural disasters is increasing. But in fact, it's not. If you know, we're doing far better at warning systems and building cities safer and whatnot. But when an event happens, it makes the news, and it makes it in the news all the way from some other part of the world. And so we're much more subject to hearing about these things and sort of thinking that the world is worse. But following from a comment earlier, we lose the concept of the arc of history. And so he advocates for, you know, going to the source and looking for things in context and highlights kind of a set of rules for like, hey, when you see a fact.
Well, you mentioned the book Factfulness, Craig. Comes to my mind is a book by Steven Pinker where he takes a lot of the news stories that are highlighted and that are emblazoned in our headlines and so forth and says they go contrary to the facts, which can be much better, like in the example you use, than we think they are. Some thoughts from you, Sam Weinberg?
It's absolutely true. Our perceptual systems are geared toward remembering and highlighting those things that are salient. In response to the caller, I think he's quite correct. One of the longstanding statistics is that far many more people die from drowning than from fires. But it's much easier on a news report on the TV to show a fire than to show a drowning. And so we tend to think that there are far many more people who die through fires. So we are geared to remember those things that are vivid. The psychologists Mark Lepper and Lee Ross called it the representative heuristic, the salience, the psychology of salience. And it's one of the things. It's a perceptual bias. And we need to be aware of it and need to take it into consideration when we quote a statistic or we think about what it is that actually we remember.
A listener tweets, history is always a matter of partisanship. That is what we need to teach. Dates are the things that can be looked up. Why, who profits? Those are the real issues. And Kenny asks, and let me get a response from you on this, Sam Weinberg, because people do want facts but are struggling with what or whom to trust. The way Kenny puts it is, what do we do about contradictory and anomalous details in multiple primary source materials?
What we do is we try to reconcile those contradictions And this is the type of thing that we need to be teaching in our history class. What do we do about, I mean, we could go back to the earliest days of the Republic and start with, for instance, what we refer to as the Battle of Lexington, April 19th, 1775. Was it really a battle or was it a massacre? And so we have different eyewitness reports. And when we look at the textbook presents it as clear cut of this happened and this happened. And what we deprive young people from doing is to sharpen their own powers of discernment. In looking at, for instance, a diary from a lieutenant, a British lieutenant, Lieutenant John Barker, who claims that his own men went wild, that they did not fire the first shot. They went wild and they put the colonists to rout. And then you have the colonists who say, wait a second, all of our backs were turned at exactly the same time. We didn't shoot first. But this was evidence that was they gathered in order to send to Benjamin Franklin, who was the colonial representative in Parliament, for propagandistic purposes. So here you have right from the start of the kind of cradle of the American Republic, contradictory evidence. Now, should we deprive students from engagement in that and tell them a cut and dried story? Or should we start American history right with that kind of controversy?
As long as you use that example, a lot of this comes down to framing and semantics. I'm thinking about how they maybe teach in the UK under the banner of the colonial revolution against Britain, as opposed to the way we teach it here, which is the triumph of colonial revolution against colonialism. I mean, you know, again, you can just frame it completely opposite.
Well, it's the same. We could go to more recent history with the way in Russia, the way that they talk about D-Day. They talk about it as the opening of the Second Front,
almost inconsequential. Robert writes, I still think that there is an important role for textbooks to provide a context for individual facts and events. Textbooks provide a synthesis, a sense of development, of change over time. That is what is often missing from individual accounts of facts or events.
Well, I think that I think that we need a sense of context, but I would advise anyone who thinks that textbooks are absolutely necessary and beneficial educationally to take their child's textbook and take it and put it by their bedstand and see if they can get through a typical chapter. Yes, we need context. We need synthesis. Let me recommend that people go out and buy Jill Lepore's These Truths, which is truly a magnificent piece of writing, provides context, doesn't hide the erasures of history, and is told in a way that is absolutely compelling.
I, too, am a big admirer of hers, and she's been on this program. Just recommend that to those who want to know more about Jill Lepore's work. It's in our archives, the interview I did with her. And here's another caller on textbooks. David, you're on. Morning.
Hi, are you talking to me?
If you're David, you're on the air and you're talking to us.
I am. Yeah. Texas Board of Education tried to downplay slavery, and since they have sway with textbooks throughout the nation, there was some blowback. Can you speak to that issue?
Well, I can speak for quite a long time about what goes on in Texas, of course. And, you know, it's not only Texas, but it's also here in California that textbooks are the product of lobbying groups and consensus, and they have the kind of coherence of the federal budget. They are a kind of mixture, a goulash, where everybody gets to have their say. And so, for instance, in the latest California standards, you have what were the dictates of textbooks? Well, it was lobby groups like groups from Muslim groups, Jewish groups, a variety, the Sikh groups from Southern California, all got their say in Sacramento and put pressure on what actually gets into textbooks. And so textbooks are in many ways a record of a political process rather than a sense of coherent history that is compelling to read and compelling to learn from.
Let me thank you for the call. David, good to hear from you. Grateful for your call. And we'll hear next from Earl. Earl, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, I think the role of poverty has to be emphasized, particularly in the African-American community. I grew up in a community where my parents did not have access to higher education. My mother was like third grade. My father was a longshoreman but was not a high school graduate. Consequently, at home, there was no emphasis on literature or library. going into high school, I remember how much I valued a set of encyclopedias, which I didn't have. I used to go to the library, but the library used to close at 9 o'clock and sort of limited my access to resources. In high school, all of the academic leadership was all white. And consequently, I think for lack of background on their part, there was no what's called Afrocentric education available. I remember in American history, there was no emphasis or mention, or was a complete void of African-American involvement in the development of this country. There was certainly slavery, but that was not a point to be valued. At least that's the way I took it.
When were you, Earl, let me ask you, when were you studying? What years are we talking about here?
We're talking about high school was 57 through 61
in
Oakland.
I was thinking we got to contextualize the time here because a lot has changed. I mean, quantum changes here in terms of coverage of African-American history and overall textbooks. But Sam Weinberg, still a lot of work to be done.
Absolutely. There's still a lot of work to be done. And I think that Earl makes some very powerful points. We can look at textbooks as a record of our changing perceptions of who we are. And as the demographics of this nation change, our textbooks will be in many ways a running record of our own sense of who we are. I think that what we're going to see in California, for instance, is a much greater emphasis on the role of Mexican Americans in this country, in the western part of the United States. And that, I think, is inextricably tied to a changing demographic and a kind of rectifying the absence and erasures of that story up until this time.
Let me conclude with a comment from Carolyn, who writes, when I was a history student at Cambridge in the 60s, my tutor in British history wrote at the bottom of my first essay, quote, bite hard on every coin you are given to be sure if it's real. I think that's a good motto for reading critically. Thank you, Sam Weinberg. Good to have you with us.
And thank you, Michael.
Sam Weinberg, again, professor of education at Stanford, author of Why Learn History When It's Already on Your Phone. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion. In fact, we encourage you to do so online by going to our website at kqed.org/forum. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I thank you for listening and being a part of the program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.